Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
One day after passing an historic rewrite of state water regulations, a House panel today began surveying state land policy.
What does that look like when you put it all together, and where is the most critical need for us to focus that money?
Also tonight, as Florida lawmakers gear up to start addressing the state's mental health and substance abuse issues, some say this year's proposal will not be a one-size-fits-all solution.
So it's a work in progress. We are going to start this year, and we will continue the endeavor over these next 2 years.
We'll also check out what the legislature is doing about invasive lionfish, a popular program for people with disabilities, red light cameras, and inexperienced structural engineers. It's the end of week one of the 2015 Florida legislative session. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. With the ink barely dry on its water policy legislation, the House is already mapping out a plan for land conservation. As Jim Ash reports, Republican leaders began focusing today on Amendment 1 and how it fits into preserving and managing wilderness acres.
Environmentalists smelled victory as soon as Amendment 1 reached the November ballot. The same day 75% of voters approved it, visions of wildlife preserves, white beaches, and sparkling springs danced in their heads.
I think have overwhelmingly demonstrated their support for increased state funding for water and land conservation, and we're hoping to carry that message into the legislative session in 2015.
Now that Amendment 1's funneling $750 million tax dollars into the environment, Republican House leaders are beginning to focus their gaze on the state's 12 million acres of public wilderness.
What does that look like when you put it all together, and where is the most critical need for us to focus that money?
That's House State Affairs Committee Chairman Matt Caldwell. The Republican from North Fort Myers was describing his committee's informational hearing on state land policy. Committee members listened to State Lands Director Kelly Borey give a few examples of the Department of Environmental Protection's land preservation efforts in the past year.
We've protected Brunson Springs in Washington County. We've acquired more than 900 acres in the Florida Keys Ecosystem Project.
Borey's dry recitation is a perfect example of what most voters pictured when they filled in the little circle for Amendment 1, setting aside land to keep a step ahead of the bulldozer and the next strip mall. But to some conservative Republicans, Amendment 1 opens the door to an old debate. Why take more property off the tax rolls? Why not manage the land we already have? In fact, Representative Ray Pilon, a Republican from Sarasota, thinks regulators should rethink the land we've already bought.
We want to make sure that the land that we have is managed properly, and that any land that is in current ownership that might need to be surplused to continue on that, because sometimes it's not environmentally valuable.
And as the land debate heats up, some of the dispute is spilling over into the group that wrote Amendment 1. Ken Bryan, director of Rails to Trails Conservancy, thinks 10% of Amendment 1 money should go to completing a bike and nature trail from Pensacola to Key West.
And we're still having difficult conversations with our sister organizations about how do we get the resources that we need to trail so we can make this thing happen.
The House passed its massive rewrite of state water policy in the first 3 days of session. Crafting a land state policy could take weeks. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Florida lawmakers are looking into reforms related to mental health and substance abuse issues and how all that ties into the state's child welfare system, as we hear from Sasha Cordner.
There have been several high-profile child deaths that have occurred in recent months under the supervision of the Florida Department of Children and Families. Among them is Phoebe Johnchuk, whose father is accused of throwing her over a bridge during what appeared to be a psychotic breakdown. According to a state report and DCF's own secretary, Mike Carroll, the state's abuse hotline ignored a couple calls to the hotline about John Johnchuk, who is bipolar, before Phoebe's death. Carroll says, in addition to mental health, Phoebe's death highlighted some other areas DCF struggles to address, including substance abuse issues, areas Stewart Republican Gail Harrell hopes to address.
We're in the process of planning
a work plan for addressing mental health and substance abuse. But this is going to be a major endeavor for this committee, and I want to make sure that everyone is participating and everyone is a part of the solutions that we are looking forward to.
Harold chairs the House Children, Families, and Senior Subcommittee and recently held a three-hour hearing looking into these issues. Part of it was mental health and substance abuse panel discussion. Sean Salamito was one of the panel members. He's with Families First Network community-based care lead agency. CBCs is their known work with DCF to provide services for foster care youth and parents. Providing an example of why he says mental health and substance abuse services are necessary in his line of work, he talked of a situation normally encountered in the child welfare system, a mother and her infant who came to the attention of DCF due to the mother's drug use.
She was leaving the child unsupervised and not providing proper care while she used drugs. Her child was removed and placed into foster care. Mom needed substance abuse treatment to get off drugs and to learn the skills necessary to be a suitable parent. The child needed infant mental health services to address his trauma and establish a healthy parent-child attachment, which is essential for his neurological development. It wasn't long before we learned that when Mom was a child, she had been sexually abused by a relative over a prolonged period of time. She had never received any treatment to address her trauma, which had led to depression, drug use, and other maladaptive behaviors.
Some advocates say reform is needed, but a mental health expert with the University of South Florida, Dr. Mary Armstrong, recommends allowing a new law take its course. It's an overhaul of the state's child welfare agency to help prevent child abuse-related deaths.
I really think we need to stay the course. Right now, I'm not suggesting that we do another major system reform here in Florida. Members of the panel may think that's necessary. I think we need to stay the course and work on improving what's already in place.
She says some areas that could be expanded include making the public more aware about mental health issues to reduce the stigma, as well as creating some sort of collaborative structure at the state level.
That's responsible for persons with behavioral health problems. Key agencies that need to be included, obviously, are the Department of Children and Families, Agent ACA, Veterans Affairs, Education, Law Enforcement, the Department of Health.
Another panelist was Linda McKinnon with Central Florida Behavioral Health Network, Florida's largest managing entity, which manages local contracts for substance abuse and mental health services. She says those services are suffering from a lack of funding, as well as a fragmented funding system.
Funds for mental health and substance abuse run through various agencies like the department, ACA, local counties, Department of Corrections, DJJ, DOE, and the Department of Health. None of that information is integrated. The fragmentation means people who need help fall through the cracks. A solution would be that all behavioral health funds be channeled through and administered through a managing entity or its like.
Ann McKinnon says the system is also under-resourced.
Florida only spends about $39.55 per capita, while the national average is $120 per capita. The solution would be to start this year by appropriating $42 million to community-based funding mental health and substance abuse treatment services.
Meanwhile, with all the suggestions Representative Harrell expects to get from her fellow lawmakers on ways to revamp the mental health and substance abuse systems, she says she doesn't see it as a one-size-fits-all solution. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
A state senator says he doubts that the Florida Senate would pass a bill making it a crime for transgender people to use a restroom that doesn't match the gender they were assigned at birth. The measure by Representative Frank Artiles, a Miami Republican, passed the House Civil Justice Subcommittee this week on a 9-4 party line vote. Artiles says he sponsored the bill in response to Miami's new ordinance protecting transgender rights because it would allow men to enter women's restrooms to commit crimes. But few Senate Democrats are giving the bill much chance for passage in their chamber. Under the bill, those caught using a single-sex restroom that doesn't match their gender at birth would be charged with a first-degree misdemeanor, punishable by $1,000 in fines and up to 1 year in jail. Still to come on Capitol Report, for people who have received the $158 ticket in the mail, red light cameras probably aren't very popular, but some lawmakers are pointing to different concerns.
So we're in a situation where we're bringing in $100 million and we can't make a statement to the public that we're making them safer. Is that a fair assessment?
A bill backed by powerful lawmakers has disability advocates fearful a key department could be privatized. But former Senate President Don Gates says that's not the case.
It's a flag, motherhood, and God bill. I can't imagine why anybody would be opposed to it unless they think their own personal rice bowl is being chipped.
Florida Tax Watch goes angling for the invasive and destructive lionfish.
Matter of fact, the lionfish swam around the middle of the tank, not even fearful of being by those grouper.
And will get down and dirty during a celebration of National Nutrition Month.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment.
Using cameras to snag red light runners got the green light in Florida years ago, but now a state lawmaker is calling for those green lights to turn yellow. As Nick Evans reports, Senator Jeff Brandis is pushing for municipalities to report on existing red light cameras and to try alternative measures before setting up more.
So imagine you're lost, driving through a new city. The streets are crowded, you're not exactly sure what your destination looks like, and then that oh-so-helpful backseat driver lets you know you just passed it. No problem, there's an intersection up ahead and you'll hang a right, make a block, and find some parking. But just as you get there, it goes yellow, and then red. And maybe you kind of rolled through on the red light, but you're pretty sure you're fine. Well, depending on the city, you may soon have a ticket in your mailbox, complete with a picture of your face behind the wheel. That is, if a red light camera is installed at the intersection. Since Florida made it legal to use them, traffic violation detectors, that's what lawmakers call them, have become very popular.
Down a little bit this year, but you see, it's ranged from 999,000 in the 11-12 fiscal year, a little over a million last year, and this year the jurisdictions reported almost 941,000 notices of violation that are being issued at the local jurisdiction.
That's Dave Westbury from the Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles. And there's no doubt the cameras catch more violations than traffic cops. Compare that more than 900,000 notices to less than 60,000 tickets written by police that observe an infraction. But there's one problem with red light cameras. It's not clear they make intersections safer.
Similarly, in the front-to-rear crashes, 30 of the jurisdictions reported an increase, only 16 a decrease, and 3 with no change in that.
So this is a decrease over from when they had previously installed before they had red light cameras, and now they've installed red light cameras, and the accidents have actually gone up?
Yes, sir. We asked them for...
That's Senator Jeff Brandis questioning Westbury. The St. Petersburg Republican chairs the Senate Transportation Committee. But Westbury's numbers are far from conclusive. Although most jurisdictions that reported saw an increase in crashes, most also saw a decrease in injuries. But the data doesn't cover all the state's cameras, and the municipalities can set up their own rules for things like right turn on red. So Brandis is proposing two changes to the state's camera laws. First, he wants to improve oversight by requiring cities and counties using red light cameras to submit annual reports. Second, he wants them to show alternative measures have been tried before a red light camera goes up.
Things like restriping intersections, things like making signs brighter, things like extending the time of a yellow light.
But some senators are critical of Brandis' proposals. Orlando Democrat Geraldine Thompson says requiring some countermeasures before others could unnecessarily delay safety improvements.
I'm very concerned about the life and safety of Floridians, and to require a jurisdiction to go through all of these steps if an intersection has already been identified as a dangerous intersection, I think is problematic.
But Newport Richie Republican Wilton Simpson points to the problem many who agree with Brandis see in red light cameras.
We have used red light cameras as cash registers. Clearly, there's not definitive proof that they save lives. They might actually cause more accidents in some areas.
At about $160 a piece, tickets from red light cameras have been a boon for localities continually short on cash. Not surprisingly, lobbyists with the Florida League of Cities and the Association of Counties voiced opposition to the plan. The measure did pass committee, but with so much money on the line, it seems likely to face stiff resistance as it moves through its final two committee stops. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Florida House and Senate leaders have boasted about an ambitious agenda to improve the lot of folks who have disabilities. But as Lynn Hatter reports, some disability rights groups fear a proposal in the legislature filed by two powerful lawmakers could privatize one of the important job placement programs that people with unique abilities rely on.
The state has its sights set on the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, which helps people with physical or mental disabilities get and keep jobs. There's a plan to bring some changes to voc rehab, but few lawmakers know about it.
I'm not aware of it.
Tallahassee Democratic Representative Alan Williams attended a rally Thursday for persons with disabilities at the Capitol, and he says it's the first time he has heard about the bill.
Let's make sure that any services that they are currently providing, that we do not lose those. And quite honestly, we do everything we can to enhance those services. I mean, the folks who are out here today for this Developmental Disability Advocacy Day, it's just another testament to why our state needs to do more.
But not everyone is in the dark. Agency for Persons with Disabilities Secretary Barbara Palmer is aware of the measure, and she says she thinks it's an effort to improve vocational rehab. Palmer says the division has some big challenges ahead of it.
The federal government just sent down a mandate that everyone, especially those with severe disabilities, have to go through voc rehab before they can get any other types of services. So we're working with them so that we can not only help them on the front end, but at the other end, after they've gone through training, if they need follow-along services.
I'm not sure what prompted the bill. If they didn't believe the outcomes from voc rehab, specifically for people with developmental disabilities, was what they believed it should be.
Deborah Linton is the executive director of the ARC of Florida. Some disability advocates say they've been blindsided by the proposal. Its Senate sponsor is former Senate President Don Gates. Its House sponsor is Representative and Republican Party of Florida Chairman Blaise Ingoglia. John Probanek with the Florida Rehabilitation Council views the proposal as well-intentioned but problematic.
Unfortunately, I think the repeal of VR is absolutely an extreme measure.
The bill creates a sunset date for vocational rehab and requires the department to create a pilot partnership program with local organizations. But the big fear is that that language is a forerunner to privatization. Gates says contrary to those rumors, the program is not being privatized, nor is it being cut.
We want to make sure that there are measurable performance metrics in promoting mobility and functionality, in promoting independence where possible, employment where it's feasible, and make sure that our program here in Florida gets better and better and becomes one of the best in the country. That's the purpose of the bill, and if it passes, that's the consequence of the bill.
Both Gates and Senate President Andy Gardner are big proponents of improving the economic and educational outlook of people with unique abilities. Gates' wife is partially disabled, and Gardner's son has Down syndrome.
If they flag motherhood and God bill, I can't imagine why anybody would be opposed to it unless they think their own personal rice bowl is being chipped.
Despite Gates's reassurances, fears of privatization abound. The last time the state tried to privatize the program, it put Florida at risk of losing federal funding. In 1999, the Florida legislature privatized vocational rehab, but according to a 2003 study by the Office of Program Policy and Analysis, the program was poorly run, and the federal government labeled Florida a high-risk state. In 2002, lawmakers reversed course and moved vocational rehab under the Florida Department of Education, where it is now. The Rehab Council's Probanek and the ARC's Linton suggest voc rehab should be moved under the state's job department, the Department of Economic Opportunity, to help it better meet its mission. Gates says he's heard that recommendation before, but...
And I'm more interested, and so is President Gardner, in deploying all the resources of state and local government, our educational institutions, and everybody else who can add value to help these folks do better and have more opportunities.
A Senate committee will hear SB 802 Tuesday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The When it comes to building, Florida has its own set of unique challenges, and Regan McCarthy reports that's why one panel of lawmakers says the state's structural engineers should get a little extra practice before being licensed.
In 2007, the Berkman Plaza parking garage in Jacksonville collapsed, killing a construction worker and injuring many more. Tom Grogan, the Florida Structural Engineers Licensure Committee Chair, says that's due in part to a novice engineer.
And the person that designed that structure was a well-meaning individual who thought he could, okay, but he didn't have the background to. He was basically a professor at a university in the state of Georgia with a Florida license, and it turned out he didn't understand some of the basic concepts of structural engineering, and that happened.
Keystone Heights Republican Representative Charles Van Zant says the structural engineering industry needs more oversight.
You may have a situation where the developer says, Henry, come in here, it's already after lunchtime on Friday, we have to get these plans and specifications down to the building department for review. You just sign and seal them, and there'll be a little bonus in your paycheck Friday. And so the guy that's the PE on staff but may not know anything about structural engineering signs and seals the drawings they get down there, and the building collapses 2 years later. This is happening.
Van Zant is sponsoring a bill that creates a specialized license for structural engineers and prohibits people from working the job without the license.
Young engineer graduates from college, he's got his degree, wants to pursue structural, just like a doctor might want to pursue brain surgery or heart surgery or orthopedic or something. Structural engineering is a separate discipline within the realm of engineering.
But some lawmakers, like Orlando Democratic Representative Randolph Bracey, worry Van Zant's law creates something of a catch-22. He asked Van Zant about that during a hearing on the subject in the House Regulated Industries Committee.
In your bill, you are requiring 4 years' experience of structural engineering before they can get a license. But how do they get that experience if they don't have a license?
Van Zant says the answer to that is simple. Internships.
So they would seek out a structural engineer to place themselves under for 4 years to practice and evaluate, learn to make the drawings and all of those things that structural engineers do for 4 years, and then he would at that point be eligible for qualification as a structural engineer.
Van Zant's measure includes carve-outs for existing engineers who are sole proprietors and can sign an affidavit attesting to their experience, and would recognize those licensed in other states. The measure passed the committee and heads next to the full House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Florida's fishing industry has dealt with its fair share of problems, from oil spills to grouper shortages. But as Matthew Seeger reports, an article from Florida Tax Watch exposes another problem: ecological damage caused by a hungry little troublemaker known as the lionfish.
The signature fin stripes on the extravagant lionfish may look beautiful, but unfortunately for Florida, those are looks that can kill. The red lionfish, or Pterosus volitans, has been on the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission's most wanted list since the mid-90s. It's an invasive species native to the Indo-Pacific region. Amanda Nally, public information specialist of the FWC, explains just what makes these striped bandits so malicious.
They do have quite a voracious appetite and tend to move on to reefs and basically eat up all the other species that are on there that they can eat. And then they also compete with larger species, especially predatory species like grouper and snapper that are on those reefs as well.
The hook here is that those large predators aren't doing the same thing to the lionfish. For some reason, lionfish aren't just unappetizing, other fish are downright dodgy around them. Again, Nally.
There was a great piece of research where they put a lionfish into a tank with some Nassau grouper that had not eaten in several days. And those Nassau grouper did not eat that lionfish.
No one's quite sure what brought the little bugger to our waters, but it still caused a headache for the local fishing industry. This was the subject of an article included in a publication of the Florida Tax Watch, whose report came on the heels of last week's National Invasive Species Awareness Week. Robert Weissert, the Senior Vice President for Research at Tax Watch, explains the extent of the damage.
What we've seen over the last years is a potential decrease in some of the important fish species that make up important parts of Florida's fishing industry.
Lionfish had found a veritable buffet here in Florida's waters, with little competition from other predators. In fact, a study from the Oregon State University back in 2012 showed that the insatiable little so-and-sos managed to reduce native fish population in the Bahamas by about 65% in just 2 years. In fact, they're now more common here than they are in their waters of origin. But according to both Weissert and Nally, there's pushback. It turns out, if you take out the spines and fillet them, the suckers are darn good eaten. In fact, Nally says that, unlike puffers or fugu fish, whose toxins are flesh-based, the venom in the lionfish is localized to their stingers and can even be neutralized with heat.
Laying is actually pretty easy to do. It's pretty easy to avoid those spines.
The biggest issue with combating the reign of terror, Nally says, is ignorance.
A lot of people, you'd be really surprised, aren't aware that lionfish are an issue. They aren't aware of how lionfish ended up in our waters. They aren't aware that you can eat them or that they're found in restaurants.
Lionfish populations have been drastically rising since their introduction and have slowly made their way up the East Coast. Florida's saltwater recreational and commercial fishing industries are huge, and Weissert says that the damage being done by the lionfish is already having serious consequences.
So in total, we're talking about 175,000 jobs in two industries that could potentially be negatively affected by this invasive species.
As of yet, there isn't any real consensus on how to get rid of the lionfish. They're still not well understood, even in their native waters. For now, turning this hunter into prey by encouraging people to catch them is the only real weapon in the conservationist's arsenal. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Matthew Seeger.
You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, here's a flip on the old musical question. How you gonna keep them down in the city after they've seen the farm? Florida agriculture officials are celebrating National Nutrition Month with local students. Vanity Duran reports the kids dirtied their green thumbs in the garden.
So remember when we looked at all the different kinds of potatoes? There's red potatoes. What other color potatoes?
Purple! In celebration of National Nutrition Month, the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services is hosting kindergarten and third grade students from Roberts Elementary School. The students will plant potatoes and learn about the garden. Third grade teacher Darlene Laurie says Roberts Elementary has a school garden of its own.
We're loving it because in our science class we're studying living things and watching seeds germinate, and we're planting. And at our school at Roberts, we're really lucky because we have a garden there.
Third grader Tyler Schnicker says he's learned about the different types of potatoes and mustard greens.
I saw a lot of different plants, and I learned to plant a potato.
Farm-to-school director Lindsay Grubb says the department's whole seasonal workshops to teach students more about where food comes from and encourage healthy choices.
The reason why we do this is we want kids to learn, you know, the raw state of foods, of how they're grown, and then also provide them the chance to be able to taste it and learn what it tastes like to be fresh.
Students also got to sample snacks made with the fresh grown food. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Vanity Duran.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Matthew Seeger. We also thank Vanity Duran and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2015 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.